however, was missing. They searched for him high and low, in the rooms of the East Wing, the West, and the Main, at the shooting range, the tennis court, the croquet pitch, and the gymnasium, until finally at 9 that morning, Reg set out for London with 11 recruits instead of 12. It was Quill who found the length of rope beneath his window and the tiny swatch of fabric flying like a pennant from the wire atop the perimeter fence and the fresh footprints along the beach made by a man in a hurry who weighed approximately 200 well-defined pounds. A pity, thought Quill. 10 more just like him, and Britain would have ruled the world again. Chapter 6 Wormwood Cottage, Dartmoor. The precise route of his escape, like Saladin's flight from America, was never reliably established. There were clues, however, such as the Volkswagen Jetta, pale blue, reported stolen from the car park of Morrison's supermarket in Gosport at 10:15 that same morning. It was discovered later that afternoon, some 100 miles to the west in Devon, parked outside a post office and general store in the tiny hamlet of Coldeast. The tank had been topped off with petrol, and on the dash was a note, handwritten, apologizing for any inconvenience to the owner. The Hampshire Constabulary, which had jurisdiction in the matter, commenced an investigation. It ended quite abruptly after a phone call from Tony Quill to the chief constable, who duly surrendered the note along with all surveillance video from the Morrison's car park, though later the chief was heard to remark that he'd grown weary of the antics by the lads from King Henry's old grey fortress. Playing spy games on the streets of Portsmouth was one thing, but stealing some poor sod's car, even for the purposes of a training exercise, was just bad manners. The town of Coldeast was noteworthy only in that it lay at the edge of Dartmoor National Park. The skies were pouring with rain on the day in question, and it was prematurely dark. As a result, no one noticed Christopher Keller as he set off along the old Liverton Road, a rucksack over one shoulder. By the time he reached the Liverton Village Hall, the night was as black as India ink. It was no matter, he knew the way. He turned into a hedgerow track and followed it due north past the old Lays farm. Once, he had to step onto the verge to allow a rattletrap farm truck to pass, or otherwise it seemed as though he were the last man on the face of the earth. Britain is better off now that you are here to look after her. At Brimley, he tacked to the west and followed a series of footpaths to Postbridge. Beyond the village was a road that appeared on no map, and at the end of the road was a gate that whispered quiet authority. Parrish, the caretaker, had neglected to unlock it. Keller scaled it without a sound and hiked up the long gravel drive toward the limestone cottage that stood atop a swell in the bleak moorland. A yellow light burned like a candle over the unlocked front door. Entering, Keller wiped his feet carefully on the mat. The air smelled of meat and aromatics and potato. He peered into the kitchen and saw Miss Coventry, powdered and vaguely formidable, standing before an open oven, an apron tied around her ample waist. "Mr. Marlowe," she said, turning, "we were expecting you earlier."
"I got a bit of a late start."
"No trouble, I hope?"
"None at all."
"But look at you, poor lamb. Did you walk all the way from London?"
"Not quite," said Keller with a smile.
"You're dripping water all over my clean floor."
"Can you ever forgive me?"
"Unlikely." She relieved him of his sodden coat. "I've made up your old room for you. There's clean clothing and some kit. You've time for a nice hot bath before C arrives."
"What's for dinner?"
"Cottage pie."
"My favorite."
"That's why I made it. A nice cup of tea, Mr. Marlowe? Or would you like something stronger?"
"Perhaps a little whiskey to warm the bones."
"I'll see to it. Now go upstairs before you catch your death."
Keller left his shoes in the entrance hall and climbed the stairs to his room. A change of clothing was laid out neatly on the bed. Corduroy trousers, an olive drab sweater, undergarments, a pair of suede brogues, all appropriately sized. There was also a pack of Marlboros and a gold lighter. Keller read the engraving, "To the Future." No salutation, no name. None was necessary. Keller stripped off his wet clothing and stood for a long time beneath a scalding shower. When he returned to his room, a tumbler of whiskey stood on the nightstand, atop a white MI6 doily. Dressed, he carried the drink downstairs to the drawing-room, where he found Graham Seymour sitting before the fire, elegantly draped in tweed and flannel. He was listening to the news on the ancient Bakelite radio.
"The stolen car," he said, rising, "was a nice touch.
Better to make a bit of noise in a case like this, isn't that what you taught me back in the day?"
"Did I?"
Seymour gave a mischievous smile.
"I'm only glad it was accomplished without resort to violence."
"An MI6 officer," said Keller, with mock severity, "never resorts to violence. And if he does feel the need to draw a weapon or throw a punch, it's only because he hasn't done his job properly."
"We might have to rethink that approach," said Seymour. "I'm only sorry to lose a man like Peter Marlowe. I hear his IONEC scores are rather impressive. Andy Mayhew was so distraught over your disappearance, he offered his resignation."
"But not Quill?"
"No," answered Seymour. "Quill's made of sterner stuff."
"I hope you weren't too hard on poor Andy."
"I took the blame myself, though I did order a full review of the fort's perimeter security."
"Who else knows about our little ruse?"
"The controller for Western Europe, and two of his most senior desk officers."
"What about Whitehall?"
"The Joint Intelligence Committee," said Seymour, shaking his head, "is totally in the dark. The JIC were the overseers and taskmasters of MI5 and MI6. They set priorities, assessed the product, advised the Prime Minister, and made certain the spies played by the rules. Graham Seymour had reached the conclusion that the Secret Intelligence Service needed room to maneuver, that in a dangerous world, with threats all around, it had to get a bit of chalk on its cleats from time to time. Thus his renewed relationship with Christopher Keller.
"You know," said Seymour, his eyes moving over Keller's sturdy frame, "you almost look like one of us again. It's too bad you have to leave."
They went into the kitchen and sat down at the table in the snug little alcove, with its leaded windows overlooking the moorland. Miss Coventry served them the cottage pie, with a claret from the well-stocked cellar, and a green salad for their digestion. Seymour spent much of the meal interrogating Keller about the IONEC. Of particular interest was the quality of the other members of the intake.
"Don't you see the assessments and scores?" asked Keller.
"Of course. But I value your opinion."
"Finch gives snakes a bad name," said Keller, "which means he has the makings of a fine spy.
Baker's scores were quite good, too.
So is the first chapter of the thriller he's working on."
"And the course itself?" asked Seymour. "Did they manage to teach you anything?"
"That depends."
"On what?"
"How you intend to use me."
With a spy's careful smile, Seymour declined Keller's invitation to brief him on his maiden voyage as a full-fledged MI6 agent. Instead, as rain pelted the windows of the alcove, he spoke of his father. Arthur Seymour had spied for England for more than 30 years. But at the end of his career, when he was blown to Kingdom Come by Philby and the other moles and traitors, the service sent him down to the grey pile of stone by the sea to light the secret fire within the next generation of British spies.
"And he hated every minute of it," said Seymour. "He saw it for what it was, the end of the line. My father always thought of the fort as a crypt into which the service tossed his battered old corpse."
"If only your father could see you now."
"Yes," said Seymour distantly. "If only indeed."
"He was hard on you, the old man?"
"He was hard on everyone, especially my mother. Fortunately, I was little more than an afterthought. I was with him in Beirut in the 60s when Philby was there, too. Then he shipped me off to school. After that, he was someone I saw only a couple of times a year."
"He must have been disappointed when you joined MI5.
"He threatened to disown me. He thought MI5 were policemen and proletarian plods, as did everyone else at MI6.
"So why did you do it?"
"Because I preferred to be judged on my own accomplishments. Or maybe," said Seymour after a moment, "I didn't want to join a service that had been gutted by traitors. Maybe I wanted to catch spies instead of recruit them. Maybe I wanted to stop IRA bombs from exploding in our streets." He paused, then added, "Which is where you came in."
There was a silence.
"We did good work together in Belfast, you and I. We stopped many attacks, saved countless lives. And what did you do? You ran off and joined Donosati's little band of assassins.
You left a few things out of your account.
Only for the sake of time.
Seymour shook his head slowly.
I grieved for you, you bastard. And so did your parents. At your memorial service I tried to comfort your father, but he was inconsolable. That was a terrible thing you did to them.
Keller ignited a cigarette and then handed the new gold lighter to Seymour.
Do you remember what the inscription says?
Point taken.
It's all in the past. You've been fully restored, Christopher. You're as good as new. All you need now is a nice girl to share that beautiful home of yours in Kensington.
Seymour reached for Keller's cigarettes but stopped himself.
£8 million. Quite a tidy sum. By my calculation, that leaves you with a mere $25 million, all of it earned by working for Donosati. At least the money is in a fine British financial institution now, instead of those Swiss and Bohemian banks you were using. It's been repatriated, just like you.
We had a deal, said Keller quietly.
And I intend to abide by it. Don't worry. You can keep your ill-gotten money.
Keller made no reply.
And the girl? Asked Seymour, changing the subject. Any prospects? We'll have to vet her thoroughly, you realize.
I've been a bit busy, Graham. I haven't had a chance to meet many girls.
What about the one who proposed to you at the Druid's Arms?
She was quite drunk at the time. She was also under the impression I was French.
Seymour smiled. She won't be the first to make that mistake.
Chapter 7 London, Corsica. It had been 15 years since Christopher Keller had willingly allowed his photograph to be taken. On that occasion he had been perched atop a wobbly wooden stool in a little shop high in the mountains of central Corsica. The walls of the shop had been hung with portraits, brides, widows, patriarchs, all unsmiling, for the inhabitants of the village were a serious lot who were suspicious of outsiders and modern gadgets, like cameras, which were thought to be dispensers of the evil eye. The photographer was a distant relative of Don Antonio Sati, a cousin of some sort by marriage rather than blood. Even so, he had been fearful in the presence of the hard, silent Englishman who, it was rumored, carried out assignments for the Osati clan that ordinary Tallinaggio could not. The photographer had taken 6 pictures that day. In none did Keller look remotely the same. They appeared in the 6 false French passports Keller used throughout his career as a professional assassin. 2 of the passports were still valid. 1 he kept in a bank vault in Zurich, the other in Marseille, a fact he had neglected to tell his new employers at the Secret Intelligence Service. One never knew, he reasoned, when one might require an ace in the hole. The technician who took Keller's photograph for MI6 had been unnerved by his subject, too, and consequently had worked with unusual haste. The session took place not at Vauxhall Cross. Keller's exposure to the building was to be strictly limited, but in a basement in Bloomsbury. The finished product showed an unsmiling man of perhaps 50 who looked as though he had recently returned from a long holiday in the sun. His name, according to the passport in which the photo was eventually placed, was Nicholas Evans, and he was not 50 years old, but 48. MI6 provided Keller with a British driver's permit in the same name, along with 3 credit cards and an attaché case stuffed with files related to his cover, which had something to do with sales and marketing. Keller also took possession of an MI6 mobile phone, which would allow him to communicate securely with Vauxhall Cross while in the field. He assumed, rightly, that Vauxhall Cross could in turn use the phone to monitor his movements and, if necessary, eavesdrop on his conversations. Therefore, he planned to part company with the device at the first opportunity. He left London the following morning on the 5:40 Eurostar to Paris. It arrived at 9:15, leaving Keller the better part of 2 hours to determine whether he was being watched. Using the techniques taught to him by Mayhew and Quill at the fort, and a few others he had picked up on the streets of West Belfast, he established beyond a shadow of a doubt that he was not. His next train, the TGV to Marseille, departed the Gare du Lyon at 11:30. He passed the journey working diligently on his laptop for the sake of his cover, while beyond his window
the Cezanne colors of the south, chrome yellow, burnt sienna, viridian, ultramarine, flashed through his peripheral vision like a pleasant memory from childhood. He arrived in Marseille at 2 and spent the next hour wandering the grimy, familiar streets of the city center until certain his arrival had gone unnoticed. Finally, in the Place de la Joliette, he entered a Société Générale private bank where Monsieur Laval, his account manager, granted him access to a safe deposit box. From it he took his false French passport, along with 5,000 euros in cash. In it he placed his MI6 phone, passport, driver's permit, credit cards, and laptop computer. Outside, he walked a short distance along the Quai du Lazaret to the ferry terminal, where he purchased a ticket for the overnight crossing to Corsica, with first-class accommodations. The man at the counter thought nothing of the fact he paid in cash. This was Marseille, after all, and the ferry was bound for Ajaccio. In a nearby café, he ordered a bottle of Bandol Rosé and drank it halfway down the label while reading Le Figaro, content for the first time in many months. An hour later, alert but pleasantly inebriated, he was standing at the prow of the ferry as it carved its way southward into the Mediterranean, the words of an ancient proverb running through his thoughts. He who has two women loses his soul, but he who has two homes loses his mind. Shortly before dawn, Keller woke to the smell of rosemary and lavender drifting through the half-open window of his cabin. Rising, he dressed in his gray and white English clothing and, 20 minutes later, filed off the ferry in the company of a family of lumpy Corsicans who were more ill-tempered than usual due to the earliness of the hour. In a bar across the street from the terminal, he asked if he could use the telephone to place a local call. Under normal circumstances, the proprietor might have shrugged his shoulders in dismay at such a request from a foreigner, or, if so moved, he might have explained that the telephone had been out of order since the last Sirocco. But Keller delivered his request flawlessly in the dialect of the island, and the proprietor was so shocked he actually smiled while placing the phone atop the bar. Then, unsolicited, he prepared for Keller a cup of strong coffee and a small glass of cognac, for it was very cold that morning, and a man couldn't face such weather without a little something to fortify the blood. The number that Keller dialed was unknown to all but a few residents of the island and, more important, to the French authorities. The man who answered seemed pleased by the sound of Keller's voice and, curiously, not at all surprised. He instructed Keller to remain at the café. He would dispatch a car to collect him. It arrived an hour later, driven by a young man named Giancomo. Keller had known him since he was a boy. It was Giancomo's wish to be a Tarinaggio, like Keller, whom he idolized. For now he was an errand boy for the Don. On Corsica there were worse things for a young man of 25 to be. "The Don said you were never coming back." "Even the Don," said Keller philosophically, "is wrong on occasion." Giancomo scowled as though Keller had uttered a heresy. "The Don is like the Holy Father. He's infallible." "Now and forever," said Keller quietly. They were driving along the island's western coast. At the town of Porto, they headed inland along a road lined with olive groves and laurico pine and began the long winding climb into the mountains. Keller lowered his window. There it was again, rosemary and lavender, the smell of the matcha. It covered Corsica from west to east, stem to stern, a dense and tangled carpet of undergrowth that defined the very identity of the island. The Corsicans seasoned their foods with the matcha, heated their homes with it in winter, and took refuge in it in times of war and vendetta. According to Corsican legend, a hunted man could take to the matcha and, if he wished, remain there undetected forever. Keller knew this to be true. Eventually they came to the ancient village of the Orsatis, a cluster of sandstone-colored houses with red-tiled roofs huddled around the bell tower of a church. It had been there, or so it was said, since the time of the Vandals, when people from the coasts took to the hills for safety. Beyond it, in a small valley of olive groves that produced the island's finest oil, was Don Orsatti's estate. Two armed guards stood watch at the entrance. They touched their distinctive Corsican caps respectfully as Giancomo turned through the gate and started up the long drive. He parked in the deep shadow of the forecourt, and Keller, alone, entered the villa and climbed the cold stone steps to the Don's office. He was seated at a large oaken table, peering into an open leather-bound ledger. He was a large man by Corsican standards, well over 6 feet, and broad through the back and shoulders. He was wearing a pair of loose-fitting trousers, dusty leather sandals, and a crisp white shirt that his wife ironed for him each morning, and again in the afternoon, when he rose from his nap. His hair was black, as were his eyes. At his elbow was a decorative bottle of Orsatti olive oil being the legitimate front through which the Don laundered the profits of death. "How's business?" asked Keller at last.
"Which part? Blood or oil?"
In Don Orsatti's world, blood and oil flowed together in a single seamless enterprise.
"Both." "Oil not so good. This no-growth economy is killing me. And the British with this Brexit nonsense."
He waved his hand as though dispersing a foul odor. "And blood?" asked Keller.
"Did you happen to see the story about the German businessman who disappeared from the Carlton Hotel in Cannes last week?"
"Where is he?"
5 miles due west of Ajaccio."
The Don smiled.
"Or thereabouts."
"Alive 1 hour," said Keller, quoting a Corsican proverb. "Dead the next."
"Remember, Christopher, life is just as long as the time it takes to pass by a window."
The Don closed the ledger with a coffin finality and regarded Keller thoughtfully.
"I didn't expect to see you back on the island so soon. Are you having second thoughts about your new life?"
"Third and fourth," replied Keller. This pleased the Don. He was still appraising Keller with his black eyes. It was like being studied by a canine.
"I hope your friends in British intelligence don't know you're here."
"It's possible," said Keller candidly. "But don't worry. Your secret is safe with him."
"I don't have the luxury of not worrying. As for the British," said the Don, "they're not to be trusted. You're the only inhabitant of that dreadful island I've ever cared for. If only they'd stop coming here for their summer holidays, everything would be right with the world."
"It's good for the island's economy."
"They drink too much."
"A cultural affliction, I'm afraid."
"And now," said the Don, "you're one of them again."
"Almost."
"They've given you a new name?"
"Peter Marlowe."
"I prefer your old name."
"It wasn't available. Poor chap's deceased, you see."
"And your new employers?" asked the Don.
"Every bed has lice," said Keller.
"Only the spoon," replied the Don, "knows the pot's sorrows."
With that, a companionable silence settled between them. There was only the wind and the Lauritio pine and the crackling of the matcha wood fire which perfumed the air of the Don's large office. At length, he asked why Keller had returned to Corsica, and the Englishman, with an indifferent movement of his head, implied he had come for reasons having to do with his new line of work.
"You were sent here by the British Secret Service?"
"More or less."
"Don't speak to me in riddles, Christopher."
"I didn't have an appropriate proverb at my fingertips."
"Our proverbs," said the Don, "are sacred and correct. Now, tell me why you're here."
"I'm looking for a man. A Moroccan who calls himself the Scorpion."
"And if I agree to help you?"
The Don tapped the leather cover of his ledger. Keller said nothing.
"Money doesn't come from singing, Christopher."
"I was hoping you might do it as a personal favor."
"You abandoned me, and now you want to utilize my services free of charge?
Is that a proverb, too?" The Don frowned.
"And if I can find this man? What then?"
"My friends in British intelligence think it might be a good idea for me to go into business with him."
"What line of work is he in?"
"Drugs, apparently. But in his spare time he supplies guns to ISIS."
"ISIS?" Don Rosati shook his head gravely. "I suppose this has something to do with the attacks in London."
"I suppose it does."
"In that case," said the Don, "I'll do it for nothing."
Chapter 8. Corsica. The average lifespan of Capra aegagrus hircus, otherwise known as the domestic goat, is 15 to 18 years. Therefore, the old goat belonging to Don Casabianca, a notable who owned much of the valley adjacent to the Ossatis, had most definitely overstayed its earthly welcome. By Keller's calculation, the beast had been consuming valuable oxygen for more than 24 years, much of it in the shade of the 3 ancient olive trees that stood just before the sharp left-hand turn in the dirt and gravel track that led to Keller's villa. A nameless creature with the markings of a palomino and a red beard, it blocked the path whenever it saw fit, denying access to those of whom it did not approve. For Keller, a mainlander with no Corsican blood in his veins, it harbored a particular resentment. Theirs was a long simmering contest of wills, and more often than not, it was the goat that had got the better of it. Keller, on many occasions, had contemplated ending the standoff with a well-placed shot between the goat's malevolent eyes. But that would have been a grave mistake. The goat enjoyed the protection of Don Casabianca, and if Keller were to harm one hair on its wretched head, there would be a feud. One never knew where a feud might end. It might be settled amicably over a glass of wine, with an apology or restitution of some sort, or it might go on for months or even years. Consequently, Keller had no choice but to wait patiently for the goat's passing. He felt like a shiftless son who counted his inheritance while his wealthy father, purely out of spite, clung stubbornly to life. "I was hoping," said Keller morosely, "to avoid this scene. He had a scare in October." Giancomo tapped a finger impatiently on the steering wheel. "Or maybe it was November."
"Really?"
"Cancer. Or maybe it was an infection of the bowels. Don Casabianca brought in the priest to administer last rites." "What happened?"
"A miracle," said Giancomo, shrugging.
"How unfortunate." Keller and the goat exchanged a long, tense look. "Try honking the horn."
"You can't be serious."
"It might work this time." "Obviously," said Giancomo, "you've been away for a while." With a heavy exhalation, Keller climbed out of the car. The goat raised its chin defiantly and stood its ground while Keller, fingertips squeezing the bridge of his nose, pondered his options. His usual tactic was a full frontal assault of shouted invective and waved arms, and in most cases the old goat would cede its ground and flee into the Macchia, the hiding place of scoundrels and bandits. But on that morning Keller had no stomach for a confrontation. He was travel-weary and a touch seasick from the ferry. Besides, the goat, battered old bastard that he was, had had a rough time of it lately, what with the cancer and the problem with its bowels and the extreme unction performed by the village priest. And since when did the church countenance the dispensation of holy sacraments to cloven-hoofed bovidae? Only on Corsica, thought Keller. "Listen," he said at last, leaning against the hood of the car, "life is too short for this sort of nonsense." He might have added that life is just as long as it takes to pass by a window, but he didn't think the goat, who was just a goat after all, would understand the analogy. Instead, Keller spoke of the importance of friends and family. He confessed that he had made many mistakes in life and that now, after many years in the wilderness, he was home again and almost happy. He had but one unresolved relationship, this one, and it was his wish to set it right before it was too late. Time, the conqueror, could not be kept at bay forever. At this, the goat tilted its head to one side in the manner of a man whom Keller many years earlier had been hired to kill. Then it took a few steps forward and licked the back of Keller's hand before retreating to the shade of the 3 ancient olive trees. The sun shone brightly upon Keller's villa as Giancomo turned into the drive. The air smelled of rosemary and lavender. Inside, Keller found his possessions, his extensive library, his modest collection of French Impressionist paintings, precisely as he had left them, though coated with a fine, powdery layer of dust. It was Saharan dust, he reckoned, carried across the Mediterranean by the last Sirocco. Tunisian, Algerian, perhaps Moroccan, just like the man whom Don Orsatti had undertaken to find on Keller's behalf. Entering the kitchen, he discovered the pantry and refrigerator provisioned with supplies. Somehow the Don had advance warning of Keller's return. He poured a glass of pale Corsican rosé and carried it upstairs to his bedroom. A loaded Tamfolio pistol lay on the bedside table, atop a volume of McEwen. several business suits hung neatly in the closet, the attire of the former director of Northern European Sales for the Osati Olive Oil Company, and behind a concealed door was a large selection of clothing for any occasion or assassination. The tattered denim and wool of the wandering bohemian, the silk and gold of a jet-setting one-percenter, the fleece and Gore-Tex of a mountain-climbing outdoorsman. There was even the clerical suit and Roman collar of a Catholic priest, along with the breviary and traveling mass kit. It occurred to Keller that the disguises, like his false French passports, might prove useful in his new line of work, too. He thought of his MI6 mobile phone and laptop computer expiring slowly in a bank vault in Marseille. Surely Vauxhall Cross was now aware the devices had not moved in more than 12 hours. At some point, Keller would have to tell Graham Seymour he was alive and well. At some point, he thought again. Keller changed into a pair of wrinkled chinos and a rough woolen sweater, and carried the wine and the volume of McEwen downstairs to the terrace. Stretched on the wrought iron chaise, he resumed reading the novel where he had left off, in mid-sentence, as though his interruption had been a few minutes instead of many months. It was the story of a young woman, a student at Cambridge, drawn into British intelligence in the early 1970s. Keller found he had little in common with the character, but enjoyed the book nonetheless. A shadow soon encroached on the page. He dragged the chaise across the terrace and placed it against the balustrade and remained there until the darkness and cold drove him inside. That night, an icy tramontana blew from the northeast, loosening several tiles from Keller's roof. He wasn't displeased. It would give him something to do while he waited for the dawn to find the man called the Scorpion. He passed the next few days without plan or purpose. The repair of the roof consumed only a portion of one morning, including the 2 hours he spent at the hardware store in Porto discussing the recent spate of winds with several men from the surrounding villages. It seemed the tramontana, which came from the Po, had blown more often than usual, as had the maestrale, which is how the fiercely independent Corsicans referred to the wind that came down from the Rhone Valley. All agreed it had been a difficult winter, which, according to Corsican proverbs, promised a benign spring. Keller, whose future was uncertain, declined comment. Afternoons he climbed the rugged peaks at the center of the island, Rotondo, Douro, Reynoso, and hiked across sunlit valleys of Macchia. Most evenings he took his dinner with Don Rosati at the estate. Afterward, over brandy in the Don's office, he would gently probe for details concerning the search for the Scorpion. The Don spoke only in proverbs, and Keller, who was under the discipline of an intelligence service, answered with proverbs of his own. Mainly they listened to the tramontana and the maestrale prowling in the eaves, which is how Corsican men preferred to pass the evening. On the sixth morning of Keller's stay, there was an attack in Germany, a single suicide bomber in a Stuttgart train terminal, 2 killed, 20 wounded. The usual questions ensued. Was the attacker a lone wolf, or was he acting at the behest of ISIS Central Command in the Caliphate, the one they called Saladin? Keller watched the television coverage until mid-afternoon, when he climbed into his battered Renault station wagon and drove into the village. The central square lay at the town's highest point. On three sides were shops and cafes, and the fourth was an old church. Keller took a table at one of the cafes and watched a game of boule until the church bell tolled 5 o'clock. Its door opened a moment later, and several parishioners, mostly elderly, came tremulously down the steps. One, an old woman dressed entirely in black, paused for a moment and glanced in Keller's direction before entering the crooked little house adjoining the rectory. Keller finished the last of his wine as darkness settled over the village, then he laid a few coins on the table and headed across the square. She greeted him, as always, with a worried smile and a warm, weightless hand to his cheek. Her skin was the color of flour. A black scarf covered her tinder-dry white hair. It was strange, thought Keller, how the marks of ethnicity and national origin were erased by time. Were it not for her Corsican language and mystical Catholic ways, she might have been mistaken for his old Auntie Beatrice from Ipswich.
"You've been on the island a week," she said at last, "and only now do you come to see me."
She gazed deeply into his eyes.
"The evil has returned, my child.
Where did I contract it?
In the castle by the sea, in the land of druids and sorcerers. There was a man there with the name of a bird. Beware of him in the future. He does not wish you well.
The old woman's hand was still pressed to Keller's cheek. In the language of the island she was known as a signaura. Her task was to care for those afflicted with the evil eye, though she had the power to see the past and future as well. When Keller was still working for Don Rosati, he never left the island without paying a visit to the old woman. And when he returned, the crooked little house at the edge of the square was always among his first stops. She removed her hand from Keller's cheek and fingered the heavy cross around her neck.
You're looking for someone, are you not?
Do you know where he is?
First things first, my dearest.
With a movement of her hand, she invited Keller to sit at the small wooden table in her parlor. Before him she placed a plate filled with water and a vessel of olive oil. Keller dipped his forefinger in the oil, then he held it over the plate and allowed three drops to fall onto the water. The oil should have gathered into a single gobbet. Instead, it shattered into a thousand droplets, and soon there was no trace of it.
As I suspected, said the old woman with a frown, and worse than usual. The world beyond the island is a troubled place, filled with evil. You should have stayed here with us.
It was time for me to leave.
Why?
Keller had no answer.
It was all the Israelites' doing. The one with the name of an angel.
It is my choice, not his.
You still haven't learned, have you? It's no use lying to me.
She stared into the plate of water and oil.
You should know, she said, that your path will lead you back to him.
The Israelite?
I'm afraid so.
Without another word, she took hold of Keller's hand and prayed. After a moment she began to weep, a sign the evil had passed from his body into hers. Then she closed her eyes and appeared to be sleeping. When she awoke, she instructed Keller to repeat the trial of the oil and the water. This time the oil coalesced into a single drop.
Don't wait so long the next time, she said. It's best not to allow the evil to linger in the blood.
I need someone in London.
I know of a woman in a place called Soho. She's Greek, a heretic. Use her only in cases of emergency.
Keller pushed a plate toward the center of the table. Tell me about the one they call the Scorpion.
The Don will find him in a city at the other end of one of our ferries. It is not in my power to tell you which one. He is not important, this man, but he can lead you to the one who is.
Who?
It is not in my power,
she said again. How long will I have to wait?
When you go home, pack your bag. You'll be leaving us soon.
You're sure?
You doubt me?
Smiling, she searched his eyes.
Are you happy, Christopher?
As happy as a man like me can be.
But you still mourn for the one you lost in Belfast.
He said nothing.
It is understandable, my child. The manner of her death was terrible. But you killed the man who took her from you, the one called Quinn. You received your vengeance.
Does vengeance truly heal such wounds?
You're asking the wrong person. After all, I'm a Corsican. You used to be one, too.
She glanced at the strand of leather around Keller's neck.
At least you still wear your talisman. You're going to need it. She will, too.
Who? Her eyes began to close.
I'm tired now, Christopher. I need to rest.
Keller kissed her hand and slipped a roll of euros into her palm.
"It's too much,"
she said softly, as he took his leave.
"You always give me too much."
Chapter 9. Corsica, Nice. Later that evening, in the firelit warmth of Don Rosati's office, Christopher Keller learned the man who called himself the Scorpion would be waiting 2 days hence at Le Bar Saint-Étienne on the Rue d'Abré in Nice. Keller feigned surprise, and the Don, who knew that Keller had been to see the Signora, made scant effort to conceal his irritation over the fact that the mystical old woman, whom he had known since he was a boy, had once again stolen his thunder. There was much about the encounter that even the Signora, with her extraordinary powers of second sight, could not have surmised. She did not know, for example, that the Scorpion's real name was Nuruddin Zakaria, that he held both French and Moroccan passports, that he had been a low-level street criminal most of his life and had served time in a French prison, and that he was rumored to have spent several months in the Caliphate, probably in Raqqa, which meant it was possible he was under DGSI surveillance, though the Don's men had seen no evidence of it. He was scheduled to arrive at Le Bar Saint-Étienne alone, at 2:15 in the afternoon. He would be expecting a Frenchman named Yannick Ménard, a career criminal who specialized in the sale of weaponry. Ménard, however, would be unable to attend. He was now lying 5 miles due west of Ajaccio in the watery graveyard of the Orsatis. And the guns he planned to sell Nuruddin Zakaria, 10 Kalashnikov combat assault rifles, and 10 Heckler & Koch MP7 compact machine guns with suppressors and Iklan reflex sights, were in an Orsati warehouse outside the Provençal town of Grasse.
"How much would this be worth to your friends in London?"
asked the Don. "I thought we agreed your work would be pro bono."
"Humor me."
"Menard's death might complicate things," said Keller thoughtfully.
"How so?"
"The British frown on blood."
"Is it not true you have a license to kill?"
"No," explained Keller, "it was not." Le Bar Saint-Étienne occupied the ground floor of a 3-story, pie-shaped building at the corner of the Rue Vernier. Its awning was green, its tables and chairs were aluminum and stained with spilt ice cream. It is a neighborhood spot, a place to grab a quick café crème, or a beer, or perhaps a sandwich. Tourists rarely ventured there unless they were lost. On the opposite side of the intersection was La Fantasia. Here the fare was pizza, though the accommodations were identical. Keller arrived at 1:30, and after ordering a coffee at the counter took a table in the street. He was dressed as a man of the South, not a well-to-do sort who lived in a villa in the hills or an apartment by the sea, but the kind who lived by his wits on the street. A waiter one day, a laborer the next, a thief by night. He'd done a bit of time in prison, this version of Keller, and was good with his fists and a knife. He was an excellent friend to have in times of trouble, and a dangerous enemy. He drew a cigarette from his packet of Marlboros, and lit it with a disposable lighter. His phone was disposable, too. Through an exhalation of smoke, he scanned the quiet street and the shuttered windows of the surrounding apartment buildings. He could see no sign of the opposition. Mayhew and Quill, his instructors at the fort, would have reminded him that surveillance by a professional service was almost impossible to detect. Keller, however, was confident of his instincts. He had worked as an assassin in France for more than 20 years, and yet to the French police he was nothing more than a rumor. It was not because he was lucky. It was because he was very good at his job. A small Peugeot transit van, dented and dusty, passed in the street, a North African face behind the wheel, another in the front passenger seat. So much for coming alone. Keller wasn't alone either. In violation of all known MI6 rules, written and unwritten, he was carrying an illegal Tanfolio pistol at the small of his back. Were the weapon to discharge, and were the round to strike another human being, Keller's might be the shortest career in the history of Her Majesty's Secret Intelligence Service. The Peugeot eased into an empty spot along the Rue d'Abré as a second car, a Citroën sedan, stopped outside Le Bar Saint-Étienne. It, too, contained a pair of North African-looking men. The passenger climbed out and sat down at one of the outdoor tables, while the driver found an empty space along the Rue Vernier. Keller crushed out his cigarette and considered his situation. No sign of the French security service, he thought. Only four members of a Moroccan criminal gang quite possibly linked to ISIS. He recalled the many lectures he had attended during the IONEC regarding the rules for making or aborting a meeting. Given current circumstances, MI6 doctrine dictated a hasty retreat. At the very least, Keller was obliged to check in with his controller in London for guidance. Too bad his secure MI6 phone was locked in a bank vault in Marseille. With the disposable phone, Keller snapped a photograph of the man waiting for him at Le Bar Saint-Étienne. Then, rising, he left a few coins on the table and started across the street. "He is not important," the old woman had said, "but he can lead you to the one who is." Chapter 10 Rue d'Abré, Nice. He was a citizen of the forgotten France, the great belts of suburbs, banlieues that ringed large metropolitan centers like Paris and Lyon and Toulouse. For the most part, their residents lived in shabby high-rise housing blocks that were factories of crime, drug abuse, resentment, and increasingly, radical Islam. The overwhelming majority of France's growing Muslim population wanted nothing more than to live in peace and care for their families. But a small minority had fallen victim to the siren song of ISIS, and some, like Nuruddin Zakaria, were prepared to slaughter in the name of the caliphate. Keller had encountered many like him, members of North African street gangs while working for Don Rosati. He suspected that Zakaria knew little of Islam, the tenets of jihadism, or the ways of the Salaf al-Sali, the original followers of the Prophet Muhammad, whom the murderers of ISIS sought to emulate. But the Moroccan possessed something more valuable to ISIS than knowledge of Islam. As a career criminal, he was a natural operator who knew how to acquire weapons and explosives, how to steal cars and cell phones, and where to find places for members of a terrorist cell to lay low before and after an attack. In short, he knew how to get things done without attracting the attention of the police. For a terrorist group, or an intelligence service for that matter, it was an essential skill. He was shorter than Keller by an inch or two, and powerfully built. His was not a body sculpted in a fitness club, it was a prisoner's physique, honed by relentless calisthenics in a confined space. He looked to be about 35, but Keller couldn't be sure. He had never been good at guessing the ages of North African men. In appearance, he was an archetype, a high forehead with arcs at the temples, broad cheekbones, a full mouth, dark lips. Yellow-tinted aviators shielded his eyes. Keller had the impression they were almost black. On his right wrist was a large Swiss watch, no doubt stolen. The right wrist meant he was probably left-handed, so it was the left hand, not the right, that would reach for the gun he carried just inside his partially zipped leather jacket. The bulge was quite obvious. And intentional, thought Keller. Presently, a Police Nationale unit rolled slowly past the café, an environmentally friendly Peugeot 308, a go-kart with lights and a flashy paint job. The officer behind the wheel cast a long look toward the two men seated outside Le Bar Saint-Étienne. Keller watched the car round the corner while lighting a cigarette. When at last he spoke, he did so in the Corsican way, so that Nuruddin Zakaria would know he was not a man to be taken lightly. "You were instructed," he said, "to come alone. Do you see anyone else sitting here, my friend?" "I'm not your friend, not even close." Keller glanced toward the Citroën parked across the street, and at the Peugeot van on the Rue d'Abré. "What about them?"
"Guys from the neighborhood," said Zakaria, with a dismissive shrug.
"Tell them to take a drive."
"Can't."
Keller started to rise.
"Wait."
Keller froze, and after a moment's hesitation, lowered himself back into his chair. Mayhew and Quill would have been pleased by their star pupil's performance. He had just established dominance over the source. It was a technique as old as the bazaar, the willingness to walk away from a deal. But Nuruddin Zakaria was a man of the bazaar, too. Moroccans were born negotiators. He started to reach inside his leather jacket. "Easy," said Keller.
Slowly, the hand retrieved a mobile phone from an interior pocket. Like Keller's, it was a throwaway. The Moroccan used it to dispatch a brief text message. "Ping," thought Keller,
as the message surged across the French cellular network. A few seconds later, two engines turned over, and two examples of French automotive prowess, one a Peugeot, the other a Citroën, moved off.
Happy?
Asked Nureddin Zakaria.
Rapturous.
The Moroccan lit a cigarette of his own, a Gauloise.
Where's Yannick?
Under the weather.
So you're the boss?
Keller allowed the question to pass unanswered. The fact that he was the boss, he thought, was manifest.
I don't like changes, the Moroccan said. They make me uneasy.
Change is good, Nureddin. It keeps everyone on their toes.
An eyebrow rose above the yellow-tinted aviators.
How do you know my real name?
Keller managed to appear offended by the question.
I wouldn't be here, he said evenly, if I didn't.
You speak like a Corsican, Zakaria said. But you don't look like one.
Appearances can be deceiving.
The Moroccan made no reply. The dance was almost complete, thought Keller. The dance that two seasoned criminals engaged in before getting down to business. He had no interest in seeing it come to an end, not yet. He was no longer a contract killer, he was a gatherer of information. And the only way to get information was to talk. He decided to drop another coin in the jukebox and stay on the floor a little longer. Yannick tells me you're interested in acquiring 20 pieces of merchandise.
Is 20 a problem?
Not at all. In fact, my organization generally deals in much larger quantities.
How large?
Keller glanced at the clouds, as if to say the sky was the limit.
To tell you the truth, 20 is hardly worth our time or effort. Yannick should have checked with me before making any promises. He has a bright future, but he's young.
And sometimes, added Keller, he doesn't ask enough questions.
Such as? My organization operates a bit like a government, Keller explained. We want to know who our buyers are and how they intend to use our merchandise.
When the Americans sell airplanes to their friends, the Saudis, for example, the Saudis have to promise they won't use the planes against the Israelis.
Zionist pigs,
murmured the Moroccan.
Nevertheless, said Keller with a frown, I trust you see my point. We won't fill your order without certain restrictions.
What sort?
We would need your assurance that nothing will be used here in France or against citizens of the Republic.
We're criminals, but we're also patriots.
So are we.
Patriots? Criminals.
Are you really?
Keller smoked in silence for a moment.
Listen, Nureddin. What you do in your spare time is of no concern to me. If you want to make jihad, go ahead. I'd probably make jihad too if I were in your position.
But if you use the weapons on French soil, there's a good chance they'll be traced back to my boss.
And that would make him extremely unhappy.
I thought you were the boss.
A cloud of smoke came billowing across the table. Keller's eyes watered involuntarily. He had never cared for the smell of Gauloise.
Say it for me, Nureddin. Swear to me that you won't use my guns against my countrymen. Promise me you won't give me a reason to hunt you down and kill you.
You're not threatening me, are you?
I wouldn't dream of it. I just wouldn't want you to do something you might regret later. Because if you behave yourself, my boss can get you anything you want. Do you understand?
The Moroccan crushed out his cigarette, slowly.
Listen, Habibi,
I'm beginning to lose patience. Shall we make business, or should I find someone else to sell me the guns? Someone who doesn't ask so many fucking questions. Keller said nothing.
Where are they?
Keller glanced toward the west.
Spain?
Not quite that far.
I'll take you there, just the two of us.
No, you won't.
Zakaria picked up his mobile and with a second text summoned the Citroën. Change in plan.
I don't like changes.
Change is good, Habibi. It keeps everyone on their toes.
Chapter 11 Grasse, France. Keller, as instructed, sat in the passenger seat, with Nureddin Zakaria directly behind him. The Moroccan wondered aloud whether Keller might want to place his hands on the dashboard, a suggestion Keller rejected with a few choice Corsican obscenities and a murmured proverb. Zakaria didn't bother to ask whether Keller had a gun. Keller was posing as an arms dealer, after all. Zakaria probably assumed he had an RPG in his back pocket. The Citroën stopped once on the outskirts of Nice, long enough for another North African to slide into the back seat. He was a smaller version of Zakaria, a year or two younger, perhaps, with a deep scar along one cheek. In all likelihood, Keller was now surrounded by three career criminals with ties to ISIS. As a result, he spent the next several minutes choreographing the complex sequence of moves that would be required to extricate himself from the car if the deal went sideways. There was disagreement over the path they should take from Nice to their destination. Zakaria wanted to use the A8 auto route, but Keller convinced him the two-lane D4 was a better option. They picked it up at its source, along the beach near the airport, and followed it into the foothills of the Maritime Alps, through Bio and Valbonne, and finally to the outskirts of Grasse. Keller glanced into the side-view mirror. It appeared that no other members of the gang were following. He took no comfort in this realization. The final exchange of money for goods was the most dangerous part of any criminal deal. It was not unusual for one of the parties, buyer or seller, to end up with a bullet in his head. The Orsatti Olive Oil Company warehouse in Grasse served as its primary distribution center for all of Provence. Even so, like most Orsatti facilities, it was easily missed. It stood on a dusty road called the Chemin de la Madeleine, in an industrial quarter northeast of the town's historic center. Keller punched the code into the keypad at the front gate and entered the property on foot, followed by the Citroën. Next, he opened the warehouse door and led Zakaria and the one with the scar on his cheek inside. Zakaria was clutching a stainless steel attaché case. Presumably, it contained a sum of 60,000 euros. 3,000 euros for each black market weapon. Keller thought it was a rather fair price. He threw a switch and, overhead, a row of fluorescent lights flickered to life. They illuminated several hundred wooden crates. Three contained weapons, the rest Orsatti olive oil.
"Well played," said the Moroccan.
"This is the part," replied Keller, "where you show me the money." He'd expected the usual wrangle over protocol. Instead, Zakaria placed the attaché case on the concrete floor, opened the combination latches, and lifted the lid. Tens, twenties, fifties, and hundreds, all bound by rubber bands. Keller lifted one of the bundles to his nose. It smelled faintly of hashish. Keller closed the attaché case and nodded toward the far corner of the warehouse. Zakaria and the second Moroccan hesitated and then started walking, with Keller a few steps behind, the attaché case dangling from his left hand. Eventually, they came to a neat stack of rectangular crates. With a nod, Keller instructed Zakaria to remove the lid from the topmost. Inside were five AK-47s of Belarusian manufacture. The Moroccan removed one of the guns and inspected it carefully. It was obvious he knew his way around firearms.
"We're going to need ammunition. I'm interested in acquiring 5,000 rounds. Is that sufficient for your organization?"
"I should think so."
"I was hoping that would be your answer."
The Moroccan returned the Kalashnikov to the crate. Then he handed Keller a slip of paper, folded in half. "What's this?"
"Consider it a small demonstration of goodwill."
Keller unfolded the paper and saw a few lines of French script rendered in red ink. He looked up sharply.
"Why?" he asked. "To prove to me that you are not a cop."
The Moroccan paused, then added,
"Or a spy."
"Do I look like a spy to you?"
"Appearances," said Zakaria, "can be deceiving."
His gaze settled on the second Moroccan, the one with the scar on his face.
"Prove it to me, monsieur. Prove that you are really an arms dealer and not a French spy."
"And if I refuse?"
"Then it is highly unlikely you will leave this place alive."
The second Moroccan was standing a few feet from Keller's right shoulder, Zakaria directly in front of him, next to the crates. Smiling, Keller allowed the slip of paper to fall from his fingertips. By the time it had fluttered to the floor, he had drawn the tanfolio from the small of his back. He aimed it at the face of Nureddin Zakaria.
"Very impressive," said the Moroccan, "and all the while holding the money. But perhaps you don't read so well."
"I read just fine. My hearing is quite good, too. And I'm certain you just threatened me."
"Big mistake, Habibi."
Keller paused, then said,
"Fatal, actually."
Zakaria glanced nervously at the second Moroccan, who made a fumbling attempt to draw a weapon from inside his coat. Keller's arm swung 45 degrees to the right, and without hesitation he pulled the trigger of the Tanfolio twice. The tap-tap of a trained professional. Both shots struck the Moroccan in the center of the forehead. Then the arm swung back to its original position. Had Zakaria remained motionless, he might have presented Keller with a quandary over how to proceed. Instead, he attempted to draw a weapon as well, thus making Keller's decision instinctual. Tap-tap. Another dead Moroccan. Keller returned the Tanfolio to the waistband of his trousers. Then he retrieved the slip of paper from the warehouse floor and read again the words Nourdine Zakaria had written in red ink. "Kill my friend, or I will kill you." "Change in plan," thought Keller. He placed the attaché case on the warehouse floor, next to the bodies, and went outside, with a third Moroccan set behind the wheel of the Citroën. Keller wrapped a knuckle against the driver's side window, and the glass slid down.
"I thought I heard shots," said the Moroccan. "Your friend Nourdine insisted on testing the merchandise."
Keller opened the door.
"Come inside, my friend. He has something he wants you to see."
Keller spent that night in a small hotel near the old port of Cannes, and in the morning hired a car to take him to Marseille. It was a few minutes after 10 when he arrived. He entered the Société Générale in the Place de la Joliette and requested access to a safe deposit box. The batteries of his computer and mobile phone were long dead. He recharged both on the TGV to Paris and discovered in his inbox several unread messages from Vauxhall Cross, the tone of which rose in an ascending scale of alarm. He waited until he was safely aboard his second train, a London-bound Eurostar, before informing his controller he was homeward bound. He doubted his reception would be pleasant. There were no further messages from Vauxhall Cross until his train drew into St. Pancras International. It was then he received a bland 6-word transmission stating that he would be met in the arrivals hall. His welcoming committee turned out to be Nigel Whitcomb, Graham Seymour's youthful-looking aide-de-camp, food taster, and general factotum. Whitcomb spoke not a word as he drove Keller from Euston Street to a terrace of sooty post-war houses near the Stockwell Tube station. As Keller headed up the garden walk, clutching a stainless steel attaché case that contained 60,000 euros of ISIS money, he composed the verbal report he would soon deliver to his chief. He had managed to find the ISIS operative known as a Scorpion, and, as instructed, had tried to go into business with him. Regrettably, the first transaction had not gone as planned, and 3 members of an ISIS cell were now dead. Other than that, his first assignment as an officer of Her Majesty's Secret Intelligence Service had been rather uneventful.
Chapter 12. Stockwell, London.
"Couldn't you have missed?"
"I tried," answered Keller, "but the damn fools jumped in front of my bullets."
"Why were you even carrying a gun?"
"I considered bringing a bunch of daffodils, but I thought a gun would be better for my cover. After all, they were under the impression I sold them for a living."
"Where is it now?"
"The gun? Back on Corsica, I suppose. And the bodies? A few miles to the west."
Seymour gazed disconsolately around the little sitting room. It was furnished with all the charm of an airport departure lounge. The safe house was hardly one of MI6's crown jewels. There were much grander service properties in Tony Mayfair and Belgravia. But Seymour used this one frequently, owing to its proximity to Vauxhall Cross. The automatic recording system had long ago been disabled. Even so, he checked the power module to make certain the system had not been switched on by mistake. It was located in a cabinet in the galley kitchen. The lights and signal meters were darkened and lifeless. He closed the cabinet and looked at Keller.
"Did they really have to die?"
"They weren't exactly pillars of the community, Graham. Besides, I didn't have much choice in the matter. It was them or me."
"I'd advise your friend, the Don, to give that warehouse a thorough scrubbing. Blood lingers, you know."
"Have you been watching CSI again?" Seymour made no reply. "The French police would never dare look in that warehouse," said Keller, "because they're on the Don's payroll. That's the way it works in the real world. That's why the bad guys never get caught, at least the smart ones."
"But occasionally," said Seymour, "even spies get caught. And when it involves murder, they sometimes go to jail."
"Define murder."
"The unlawful killing of another."
"If we'd wanted to be in the Boy Scouts, we would have joined the Boy Scouts."
Seymour raised an eyebrow.
"T.S. Eliot?"
"Richard Helms.
My father loathed him.
If you'd wanted the job handled by the book, said Keller, you would have given it to a career officer who had his eye on a controllerate. But you sent me instead.
I asked you to infiltrate the cell by posing as a Corsican arms dealer. I'm quite certain